Hey everyone, welcome to Wired Talks, the Wired podcast where we discuss all things crypto. So whether you're a veteran or a crypto noob, we're all learning together. This is your host, Thomas Correa. Today I'm joined by the founders of BZX, Tom Bean and Kyle Kistner. Thank you for joining.
Thanks for having us. We're glad to be here.
And Kyle, thank you for joining as well.
Thank you, Tom. Yeah, I'm happy to be here.
Absolutely. And thank you for stopping by our office in your weary travels to the West Coast. I know you guys are coming from, I believe, Atlanta, right?
Yeah, we're Atlanta-based.
Atlanta-based. Yeah. How big is the team now?
It's like seven. So, and we do have some remote people also. I mean, it's actually just Kyle and I and our attorneys are in Atlanta right now. So
it's you both and 10 other attorneys.
yeah, pretty much. Yeah.
Okay. That's great. So why don't we just kick it off with a little bit about yourselves? We'll start with Tom and then Kyle. So your backgrounds and how that led into the crypto rabbit hole.
Yeah, sure. So I worked a private sector. I was actually with Nokia and here for like 15 years. And I was just working in, I wore many different hats. I was leading developers. I was a developer at one point myself, and I was doing architecture. I was, working in data centers. So kind of all over the place, but kind of a passion of mine, a hobby was fintech. So before crypto, I was really into Forex. So I was, writing, doing algorithmic bots and stuff like, trading bots and all that stuff. So, then I really got into crypto and that, that became my passion. And Cal?
So I started getting into crypto about 2011. I heard about Bitcoin and blockchain and I thought it was extremely interesting. I was like, oh my God, he should win a Nobel Prize in economics for this blockchain technology, Satoshi. And so I got really into the space, started following it closely. When the Ethereum white paper first came out, I read it and I felt like I had seen the truth and that this was like a really exciting project. So I was going to college around that time and I'd studied like molecular genetics and computational biology. I went to graduate school, finished graduate school and was looking for something to do. Whatever was next, and I couldn't pull myself away from crypto. I was supposed to be job searching, and instead of job searching, I just couldn't stop reading white papers. And I was like, oh no, what's wrong with me? I'm going to ruin my life. I literally can't stop doing crypto. And that, me and Tom were talking about it, and he was looking for something to build because Tom is a natural builder just by nature. Like he can't stop himself from building.
Yeah, I'd had some previous ventures that I won't mention. They didn't work out so well. So, I was looking for something new to get into. So,
yeah. And, we started talking and he was looking for something to build. And I had been shooting around ideas with Stanley Kulichov about a project I was like at the time calling like Banker, that was going to maybe be based on like Bancor and using it that for like on-chain prices and liquidity for margin lending. And me and Tom got to talking and, he took it. He was like pretty serious about the idea. So I went and I wrote up like a 6-page vision paper about how it could work and how it could be built. And then we just started iterating on it from there.
Yeah, I'm especially really excited to have you guys on the show at this particular moment, because right now BZX is the product idea is a little bit more developed, of course. Mm-hmm. You have this new, I suppose, a dApp that's built on top of your product or your protocol that is a really good demonstration of the protocol. And then now the token model is also more defined and you're getting ready to showcase all this good work to people. So really excited that you picked WireTalks as a venue to do that. Before we get into what exactly BZX is, I'm just going to paint the picture for the audience of what this might look like in the traditional world. Funny enough, I was a biomedical engineer, went down that whole bioinformatics, biotech rabbit hole, much like Kyle, but I ended up in Wall Street instead. And, margin trading is something I'm very familiar with just due to that background. The idea is really to, for traders to make trades with money that they don't have, right? They have some sort of trade idea and they want to execute it, but they don't have all of the capital for that trade idea. So what they do is they get a brokerage account with Fidelity or TD Ameritrade or some sort of brokerage house. And this broker gets you a margin account where he buys the stocks for you with the capital of a brokerage firm. And he also asks you to deposit something called margin into this account to make sure that if the trade were to move against you, then the bank has some sort of recourse, right? They can go after that collateral and call the trade off, you know, if the whole collateral is eaten up or it falls below some sort of minimum maintenance margin that these brokerage houses determine. So I thought that was a good little setup for exactly how you guys hope to do this in a decentralized manner. So I'll ask you a very simple question first.
Oh, could I add something to that picture?
Go ahead.
You know, it's not just about not having the capital to execute on it. I think there's two other really important components to it, which is one that, like, without borrowing, you can't go short. You can't make money off of something going down in price. And I think that's like a really core use case. And then the second one is for market makers, they want to hedge their inventory risk, and doing so with leverage allows them to increase their capital efficiency.
Very good points to bring up. Totally agree with you. Okay, so why don't we just start with a very simple question. What is BZX and what do you hope to accomplish with the protocol?
So BZX is a margin lending and trading protocol. What that means is we allow you to go short or leverage your position using ERC, using smart contracts in a completely trustless way. We saw in the space that everyone was using pretty much Bitfinex for margin lending and trading. And Bitfinex had suffered a sort of a high profile hack, and we wanted to use it, but we felt uncomfortable with the custodial risk. So we wanted to create a solution that could bring the efficiency that shorting does to the crypto capital markets in a way that wouldn't subject people to that custodial risk.
And we looked at Bitfinex and we're like, we could decentralize this. So we kind of really started with that, a model of what they did, and kind of went from there. And, you know, we are also huge fans of 0x. So we took heavy inspiration from them as well.
Yeah, we looked at Bitfinex and we looked at 0x, and we thought that there's like a model for decentralizing Bitfinex along the lines of 0x in a way that could sort of solve the problem.
So BZX is in itself not an exchange or even just a sole margin lending platform, but it's really a protocol that can be integrated into other exchanges.
So exactly, yeah.
Send that capability out.
Yeah, we're designed to be easily, you know, to for an ecosystem to be built around us and to be easily integrated into. I mean, people can make BZX exchanges or DEXs solely just for margin trading, or they can. I mean, it fits nicely into the DEX infrastructure that's already out there. For like 0x and others.
We'll definitely dive a lot deeper into that. I do want to cover your go-to-market strategy a little bit later. Mm-hmm. But for the time being, can you provide the audience with an end-to-end overview of the protocol? Let's say, Tom, you are a leverage seeker, and Kyle is someone with idle tokens that is available for borrow.
Sure. So on the base level, there's a couple other ways we've added later, but initially it was you'd create an order, a BZX order similar to 0x. So if I'm a borrower or a lender, typically it'd probably be a lender, but they'd create a BZX order, and there's certain parameters they needed to find: initial margin, maintenance margin, expiration of the actual order itself, length of the loan, etc. Interest rate is another one, and also like what's being lent out. And you know, there's other things you can put, like what do you want to be paid interest in. And the lender doesn't define the collateral, because that can be anything that is a supported token. The borrower defines that. So once the order is created, it's hashed, and then it's signed with their private key. And then at that point, it's immutable. So that it can be distributed through any arbitrary means. It can be sent to DEXs. It could be, put on Facebook. It can, you know, wherever people want to distribute these orders, because since they're immutable, it doesn't really matter if someone goes and tampers with it. Once it comes back and it's, verified on chain, you know, if any aspect changed and it doesn't match up when we, you know, with the, based on the, you know, the hash doesn't match up, it's going to be invalidated. So it's a safe way to distribute orders off chain. And, you know, you can be confident that it's what 0x does basically. So once the order is found off chain. It's brought back and it's like, I'm a borrower and I want to, I found this order that I like. I agree with all the parameters. I'll send it into our smart contracts and, you know, it gets verified and then it gets filled. So at that point, the collateral and the interest, the full interest for the life of the loan is pulled in from the borrower and the lender's funds are pulled in. And then at that point, it's a, since it's an under collateralized loan, like you might put up, say like $50 to borrow $100 or something, or, you know, they're different ERC-20s, but you're putting in margin and you're borrowing more than you're putting up. So we have to, it's trustless. So we don't have a way to enforce payback. So it's, it gets escrowed in our contracts and then we provide all the functions that you would need for a full margin trading and lending solution and managing your collateral, you know, pulling out profits, you know, topping up your account, basically anything you would need that you could do on like a traditional margin lending platform, you do it through our smart contracts. Mm-hmm.
And is the actual trade execution, is that part of the BZX protocol or do you partner with, is that left undefined to the exchanges that
we have liquidity providers on chain. Like we're connected to Kyber and Bancor and some others. Kyber was the initial one we added.
We're not connected right now.
I'll clarify. We're working on some other connectors, but right now our main provider is Kyber. And so, you know, That's our secure price feed, and that is where we pull liquidity for margin calls. And so the trader can manage their assets with doing Kyber swaps, or they can bring a 0x order to our contract to swap out their assets.
Yeah, we have exchange wrappers for 0x and Kyber right now.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And the borrower specifies the terms, the maintenance margin, like all of the different...
Whoever makes the order. So if I'm a lender, I define that and a borrower, you know, has to agree with it. You know, if he doesn't agree with my terms, he just takes a different order. But a borrower can also set the terms that they want and a lender can come and pick that up. So it can go either way.
I see. So the maker in this situation can be either the lender or the borrower.
Correct.
Or the taker can be either or. And is this a many-to-many system where everything is pulled together?
Yeah, it is. Like many borrowers can take an order made by a lender, but a lender has to fill a full order from a borrower. Like if I want to borrow X amount, a lender has to come in and provide that or more. So yeah, it's one-to-many basically.
One-to-many.
Yeah.
Okay, I follow. How is this mechanism different from what DYDX is accomplishing?
Yeah. So in terms of DYDX, they have like a different structure to their order objects where it's kind of, we're not like experts on how DYDX does their things versus us, but I believe the lender has to be the one who's the order maker and they have to define like what token it's going to get swapped out for. And like the minimum quantity of the token that has to be swapped out for, because DYDX doesn't have any way to know, like they don't have any price feeds and they don't have any way to know.
On chain.
They don't have any way to know like what the assets are valued at. And so like, you know, because they can't really allow people to like manage their collateral in any kind of like liquid way because somebody could just come in with a 0x order and basically drain the whole contract, a malicious 0x order and drain the whole contract. So they have to set like the parameters ahead of time. And their margin liquidation approach is very different from ours.
Yeah.
Right now, like, so there's like several ways they could have gone with it. One way would have been like the lenders have to monitor the position at all times. And then like liquidate, which is a terrible user experience. So what they did was they centralized it and they act as the one who's monitoring the margin calls. So we have like a permissionless, trustless system where anybody can call in a margin call. And because we have price feeds, we can verify that this is actually done correctly. And another thing is like they have margin tokens, right? Their margin tokens are built completely differently from ours. They don't have, like, we have, like, margin loan tokens and margin position tokens.
That's the new product coming out that's going to be backing Fulcrum that we can get into.
Yep. But.
And, like, with ours, like, a lender goes and they mint their lending tokens. and a borrower goes and they mint their position tokens. But with DYDX, the way they do it is like lenders go and mint the position tokens, and then they go and they try to sell it or like on Expo or on some 0x relay, and there's no like tokenization of the margin loans. There's no like the interest rates are not dynamically calculated based on supply and demand. And so there is extremely different visions and ways that we work. Like, so for example, another example is like we are getting integrated into Augur, and we're going to be like Augur's margin calling solution. We're very well suited to be hooked into Augur because our margin calls have always used on-chain price feeds and on-chain liquidity. And Augur is essentially like an on-chain DEX. You can get the price feeds, you can get the liquidity all on-chain.
Yeah, and Augur markets are ERC-20s, and we can pull prices from Augur and derive prices. So, you know, it was kind of a good fit. We developed a custom Augur connector, and we've been, you know, iterating with their team, and we are going to be getting integrated pretty soon, so, or, you know, in the coming months, so...
Awesome.
Yeah, I wasn't done there.
Sorry. Go ahead.
I was saying the reason that we're really good for Augur is because we use this on-chain liquidation that happens atomically, whereas DYDX is set up with this hour-long Dutch auction. The other thing that's different is that our margin calls are set up to resist network congestion. So there's crowdsourced liquidation. It's a sort of like a thundering herd that comes in, whereas like if like the status ICO was going on right now, we'd probably still be able to liquidate in a timely manner. Whereas DYDX, they would be like sending out their transactions and getting stuck because they're only one person trying to get through. So if it was like a status ICO and you were using DYDX, you might like, you, and the prices needed to be liquidated, it could be possibly days before that actually went through.
Mm-hmm. So a lot of different design considerations here. You had just started to get into this, and I'd love to dive deeper. How exactly do margin liquidations work on BZX, and how are they different from other competitors?
Yeah, so our margin calls, they happen in a single transaction, and they happen very fast. So we have margin callers that are monitoring off-chain. They're constantly, you know, they're running scripts and checking for positions that are like approaching the margin maintenance level from the BZX order. And that's the level that if it hits that or drops below that, that means the order should get liquidated as soon as possible. So once it hits that, they send a transaction in to liquidate. We verify that with Kyber or, you know, any whatever price feed we're using to ensure that it is needs to be liquidated. It's actually valid. So it, you know, it's trustless. Anyone can call in. You know, if obviously it's not, it reverts, but it liquidates. It does a Kyber swap and closes out the position and, you know, fully settles everything in one transaction.
Yeah. Whereas competitors, they either centralize the process where they're just monitoring. In the approach that most people have used is that like either one of two, like the DYDX approach is that they get their liquidity from the Dutch auction, and either the lender or some central party, trusted party, needs to monitor and call in. In the case of, you know, DYDX, they did it themselves. For Dharma, they provide the liquidity centrally. They call in, they monitor centrally. Compound actually has somewhat decentralized margin calls where they allow anybody to come in and liquidate, and like they just provide centralized price feeds. So that's one model that we really like compared to like DYDX or Dharma. The only like quibble we'd have with the Compound model is that it's a flat 5% discount, and so that provides some incentives to go and, you know, create this business, so to speak. Obviously, it's difficult because they use centralized price feeds that tap into large sources of liquidity, but it's over, like, consistently overcompensating liquidators. They don't need 5%. And if they didn't consistently overcompensate them, they could run the risk that, like, nobody would call in for a margin call.
It's pretty arbitrary in our mind that it's fixed at 5%.
And what are the incentives you laid out for liquidators?
So for us, what we do is every time anybody interacts with our contract, we note that and we put that in a data structure that's updating constantly. And so this becomes a way to measure the congestion on the network. And based on the amount of gas liquidators are spending, we compensate them in a way that's just slightly more than the gas. So right now it's like 10% more than the amount of gas they used. So what this accomplishes is it brings the margin calling rewards to their marginal cost. And it also removes incentives to try to game the system because the liquidations are happening at the marginal cost. So it's not like you can like go and tamper with the price feeds in order to create a bunch of lucrative business for yourself as a liquidator.
Mm-hmm. But let's say there are a limited amount of traders in the ecosystem. There's a finite amount, right? If there are better incentives to do this on Compound, then how would you attract those same individuals to come liquidate on BZX when they're really only compensated for the gas that they consume?
Well, it's slightly more than the gas. So there is a profit opportunity there. So in our minds, the fact that there is a slight amount of profit should attract some people to it. And it's not, you know, with Compound, you have to have a complex system for sourcing liquidity. So you have to have, like, if you want to be somebody who liquidates on Compound, you need this entire infrastructure that you need to build out. Whereas for ours, it's just a script you run in the background that is computationally efficient, doesn't really cost you much. So like you can just deploy the script and it'll passively earn you income and you don't have to worry about anything.
Yeah. And, you know, we provide an example script on our GitHub. Anyone can just fire it up and use it. And anyone just wants to, you know, if there's very few margin callers, then one person or a few people are just going to be picking up that profit very easily. Like it with Compound, if there's many people fighting over that 5%, you know, it's going to, you know, lessen your chances of getting it. And plus you have to bring liquidity. So it's a bit harder to do for most people.
Because your liquidity is sourced
from Kyber.
From Kyber.
Right.
Okay.
Yeah.
And how do you think about the slippage that these trades might incur on Kyber? And what about complete like market solvency issues if this is, you know, sharp? We've already seen sharp Ethereum crashes.
Sure.
Yeah. But how do you think through that?
Yeah. So there's two things we think about in terms of this. The first is that Kyber reserves are dynamic. And what that means is that if you're a market maker, you don't necessarily want to keep your funds in a Kyber reserve. Like say all Kyber volume happened just in like one spike during the day. If you're a market maker, logically, you don't want to just keep your funds there all day when you're really only getting that volume spike at one point in it. So you want to move your money around to where the volume is. And in that sense, Kyber reserves are very vulnerable to front running. And this is actually like a feature for our protocol because as a market maker, you can be monitoring large liquidations and large movements, and you could front run margin calling transactions, place your assets in the Kyber reserve and benefit from that volume and then move out and go back to other profitable opportunities. So basically front running as a feature is one thing that we look at as a very promising thing for Kyber in terms of its liquidity. We've talked to market makers like Kraken that exhibited interest in this. In fact, it was actually brought up to us in a discussion with one of the market makers at Kraken's trading desk that was interested in the opportunity, and we hadn't even realized it was possible. And so, you know, there's as well like Ethanex. When we started talking to them about integration, they were very concerned about the liquidity risk. And they're like, well, you know, you're liquidating on Kyber. Is there going to be enough liquidity? That seems like perhaps dangerous. And we brought up the possibility that they could act as a front runner, you know, among others as well. And this really satisfied them. And so they're going to be monitoring, you know, we're getting integrated into Ethanex. And when we are, they're going to be using their own liquidity to front run margin calls and providing liquidity. So there's going to be a competitive environment too for market makers to soak up this volume. And that's like the main thing that kind of takes care of some of these liquidity risk.
Any other trading venues or market makers you're considering about plugging into that same place Kyber's in right now?
Yeah. So like right now, Kyber kind of draws from Uniswap liquidity, especially for ETHDAI. And so we're considering expanding out some of the Uniswap offerings. The problem is that Uniswap is sort of permissionless listing of reserves, and
if more susceptible to price manipulation and
And also just like malicious assets. We don't want some asset that somebody controls completely to just get listed on Uniswap and become like an attack vector for people who are lending against people who are lending. So, but we're thinking of adding Bancor, and yeah, but basically at this point, Kyber and Bancor are the two things we're going to look at as providing liquidity and price feeds. But we also have to, there's some technical work in figuring out like routing liquidity when you have multiple sources and getting the best rate.
Well, like you mentioned, through Kyber, ETHFinex will be providing their own liquidity, and they got, you know, more than we need in DeFi right now. So they got more than enough. So, and they'll also be injecting liquidity directly into our order books, which is pretty exciting.
So keeping a lot of the protocol mechanisms on chain seems to be at the ethos of BZX. And I reckon your Oracle solution is along the same rhyme and rhythm. What is BZX's Oracle solution? What are you hoping to accomplish here?
Yeah, so our Oracle solution is using on-chain DEXs. We try to use on-chain DEXs that have secure price feeds that are tamper resistant. So, for example, we're not using Uniswap's price feed just by itself, because Uniswap's price feed can be very easily attacked. Recently, the guys at Marble Protocol released Polaris, which is a very interesting solution to sort of hardening it against manipulation using checkpoints so that you can't just atomically attack the price feed in a sandwich attack. But Kyber is much more robust. A lot of people aren't aware of some of the lower level details of how the Kyber price feed works, but it actually draws prices from Uniswap, Bitfinex, Binance,
Maker,
Huobi, yeah. ETH to DAI.
Yep.
And so it uses all that on kind of like a lower level that involves like their sanity prices. And this kind of like when there's like a little bit of a like an imbalance in like, so reserve managers can kind of set like stepwise functions for like increasing the price as volume is taken. And there's going to be some latency between when they put in the reserve prices. And between that, they get to like sort of like bound the volume in a way and set like these sanity prices that draw from these multiple sources. So if somebody tried to come and throw Kyber prices very out of whack from where they should be, Kyber will start rejecting that and give the reserve managers time to come in and set new prices so that the price feed can't deviate too much from what the outside prices really should be. So using price feeds that are very hardened against manipulation that draw from these outside sources is how we kind of approach that Oracle problem.
Mm-hmm. And since the protocol is at least currently focused on, you know, ERC-20 tokens and the Ethereum ecosystem, that makes sense. Perhaps in the future, when people are borrowing and selling or borrowing and lending S&P 500 index synthetics, then you might have to look somewhere off-chain to do that. Or perhaps the on-chain books are liquid enough to do that as well then.
Right.
Anyways, want to pivot the discussion into product. Congrats on the launch of Fulcrum.
Oh, thanks.
Yeah, a really great job there. I just read the article the other day. What do you hope to demonstrate really to your developer community, your trader community, your lender community with Fulcrum?
Sure. So we you know, prior to starting on Fulcrum, we felt that like our one thing we were kind of lacking on was user experience. Like our protocol is very powerful, but it's hard for people to understand that really on a deep level. And, you know, it's, we tried to, you know, we've made it easier to integrate, but as far as just using us for the average person, it's You know, margin trading and lending is hard enough, but to understand how our protocol works and all that is another thing. So we wanted to make a really nice UX. We wanted to make it very like dead simple to go and lend out your funds or to, you know, to borrow and trade on margin. So that's kind of where we started with Fulcrum. But at the same time, we were working on also like working on an extension for the protocol and like a way to tokenize both the loan and the position. So we came up with iTokens and pTokens. So iTokens are interest-bearing versions of, you know, any asset we support. So you have like iETH, iDAI, et cetera. And if you just have idle assets, you can deposit them to iETH, and it's just an ERC-20 that basically earns you interest. You get back the iETH token, and the price of that is constantly increasing as interest is accrued back to the contract. And
unless
then,
there's a black swan event.
Sorry?
Unless there's a black swan
event. Sure, sure. Yeah, yeah. Unless there's a black swan event. But, you know, under normal circumstance, and, you know, we have a lot of measures in place to protect against those events. But assuming that doesn't happen, the price is always going to increase. So, you know, later on tomorrow, if I go and sell my token, I go and burn it, I'm going to get back more ETH than I put in. And, you know, because they're also ERC-20s and because they can be used, and there's a lot of, you know, DeFi applications of these, and, you know, they could be like collateral and multi-collateral CDPs. They could be, and also, you know, since the funds are getting lent out, there might be a period of time where you can't redeem by burning, but if there's a secondary market, like you can go in on a DEX and sell it and get out right away. So it's like loaning out your funds, but also having like instant access to get, you know, to redeem, but you might not want to redeem. Eventually, if iETH is supported everywhere, you could just spend that like ETH. And it's, I mean, there's really no reason to redeem if it's, you know, you can always get your asset back or more from that. So that's iTokens. So pTokens are the tokenized, there's kind of corollaries to the DYDX margin tokens. So they're tokenized, you can go like 4x short on ETH by just buying a token. And we do have some key differences though between the DYDX tokens. Like ours are perpetual, so there's just one contract, one short iETH contract that you ever need to deal with, or one, and that's one token. So you can just buy that, and it's that's you don't have to mint new ones every month and stuff like that.
Yeah, it rolls over internally every 28 days. And
right.
The rolling over is incentivized by the same system that we use for our margin callers. And it's like very inexpensive to roll over the contracts, because it's basically just the gas cost plus that 10%. So,
mm-hmm. And that's spread out over all of the holders of that P token. So it might be basically unnoticed. They don't even notice it. So, you know, that's another we feel is a nice UX improvement. You don't have to mint new tokens every month. You don't have to like, okay, the 28 days is done. I need to like pull my funds out of here and put them into like some other token. Especially with the iTokens, you know, you deposit there and you can come back months later and just see how high it's grown, or, you know, just get out at any time.
One thing I felt with like the DYDX implementation of pTokens was it's kind of confusing from a UX experience. When you go there, you're like, oh, I want to go short ETH. And then you have like two options with dates on it. And you're like, what is this exactly? And which one should I get into? It's a little bit like you're unsure. You're like, okay, well, why are there both of them here? Like, is one of them like better for me to get into right now or than the other? Like, which one should I be selecting? And we wanted to take away that choice and just have it be like very clear. Like, I want to go short ETH. Buy this much. Okay. Accept. Done.
Yeah. Oh, and that's what I wanted to mention about. So iTokens also have interest rates that are set algorithmically based on supply and demand. So every single iToken, well, pTokens and iTokens, you can query the actual price in the contract. So it's always accessible on chain. And the interest rates are also derived on chain. So it uses kind of, it's a little similar to how Compound does it. Like they have this utilization rate, like total borrows over total lends. And then there's a couple factors that there's a formula that sets the interest rate in. And, you know, as the collateralization rate, like more borrowers, you get closer to 100%, those rates are going to really climb. That'll influence more lenders to come in and some borrowers to pull out and vice versa. So there's going to be like a push and pull, and you get an interest rate that kind of settles on where the a market clearing rate. So and the P tokens, the position tokens, also need liquidity, obviously, because they're so the lending liquidity comes from the I tokens. So they actually can. So in any of these short ETH P tokens will borrow from the single I token global lending pool. And also anyone, what's also kind of nice about them is that anyone can do a normal protocol loan. Say you want to deal with P tokens, you just want to use our protocol for normal margin lending. You can get your lending liquidity from the I token as well.
Yeah, with the DYDX approach, like all of the lending liquidity is fragmented. Like you have to like specifically go, like if you want to lend out your ETH or whatever, you have to like, or your DAI, you have to specifically go out and lend to people, like specifically mint out from like a specific short token contract with a specific date. Like you can't just lend out to everybody who wants to borrow or who wants to use short ETH. You have to like go to like the specific leverage amount and the specific date and lend it out. But with ours, like when you lend out your ETH, it's going out to anybody who's using any amount of leverage, all dates. So it's all unified in a way for lenders.
Right. And back to Fulcrum real quick. So the P tokens and I tokens were the first step. They were a protocol extension, and we simplified the UX for margin lending and trading there. But then Fulcrum takes another step where it's, we abstract away basically anything. We make it dead simple, just a few couple clicks to loan or to margin trade.
And,
so.
And on the UX side, we came up with something that we feel as an option smooths out the process a great deal, which is being able to just send your assets to an ENS domain, like ietoken.eth, and that's it. It's lent out. You don't even have like you don't have to even deal with an interface. So right now that works for ETH. If you want to send your tokens to ietoken.eth, like that's it. Like you're lending. You got an iToken back. That was it. Like, and like we're working to make that work for ERC-20s. It's a little bit more complicated to do in a trustless way.
Yeah, because you can't, it doesn't trigger, you know, you have to go and trigger the contract. Like, you know, it's not the same as sending ETH to a contract, which can trigger it. So that's the challenge there.
Yeah, we're creating like an incentivized way for people to like monitor the tokens being sent into like the movement of the ERC-20s within the ledger and then trigger the contracts so that you can just like send your DAI to like idaitoken.eth and then boom, it's lending out your DAI. And you don't even have to mess with an interface, right? Like you just do it from your cell phone. Like you don't have to worry about anything. Mm-hmm.
I think the really interesting part is there are other protocols that have done similar things like this, but what you did is you tokenized it, right?
Right.
Which creates secondary markets for these things.
Exactly.
Which creates the opportunity for people to package these together into new investment products. I think that really opens up Pandora's box and like expands the layer 3 or 4 stuff, you know, that DeFi can accomplish. So I think that's really cool. That's really great work so far. Can you give us a glimpse into the rest of the product roadmap for the year? What's to come next?
Yeah. So now that Fulcrum is released, what we're going to be doing next is we're going to be working with wallet providers in order to integrate the iTokens deeply into that. So, and this works especially well with wallet providers that use contract wallets so that you can just send out a mass approval and then a mass lending. So you could just convert all of your assets into iTokens and make them start earning interest, like turning your wallet into like basically an interest-bearing account, unbank account, we've been calling it. And so we're going to try to work with like Gnosis Safe. We want to work with MyCrypto, Equal Wallet, Jarvis, all the wallet providers. We want to give them the option to just opt in and just flood the lending ecosystem with liquidity. We're trying to get the tokens listed on centralized exchanges so people who don't have wallets, who just keep their assets there, can opt in, can just buy the token and start and, you know, get into the ecosystem without having to, you know, move off of Coinbase or anything like that. And then down the line, we're going to be like looking into privacy and scaling. So we talked to Aztec Protocol and, you know, we started talking about things like zero knowledge liquidation proofs so that you could have a position, have a margin position, but nobody knows where you're going to get liquidated. but the margin calling script just keeps calling in and being like, is it being liquidated now? Yes or no? And but they don't know exactly like what your where your stop is, so that you can't be like stop hunted or something like that. And that could be integrated into the dark pools to give you like a really true, secure and private margin lending experience. So we want to do that. We're investigating using like ZK Starks to reduce the gas costs of the margin calls.
Yeah, ZeroX is doing a lot of work there, and we're kind of going to definitely be looking at that and see how we can adapt it for our protocol as well to really greatly scale what can be done on chain. You know, imagine being able to fill or liquidate 100 positions at once or something like that. So
awesome.
So in terms of things that are concrete and happening that we're really excited about is Augur integration. So we're actually going to be put into the Augur UI itself. We built out a widget that they can just drop in right now.
Yeah.
If you go to the Augur Discord and you go to the UI channel, you scroll up, you'll actually be able to see it. You'll be able to see all the different screens of what it looks like. You'll be able to play with the prototype of it. You can give us feedback on it. And the other thing we're really excited about is the Ethfinex integration. You know, there could be, you know, with the caveat, there could be some unforeseen technical issues. But if there's not, we're going to be, Bitfinex is going to mirror their margin order book liquidity over through our protocol so that you can access the whole Bitfinex margin order book using BZX. So we're going to be like alongside 0x in that trustless portal. And this is a really big deal because almost all of the margin activity taking place in the entire industry is taking place on these Bitfinex margin order books. So this will make us by far the most liquid DeFi protocol in the space. And that's really exciting for us.
Yeah, just imagine like the millions of liquidity being injected into DeFi all of a sudden. So yeah, we're very excited about a few things coming.
Yeah, it's really exciting. Thanks for giving us the little glimpse into the product roadmap. I want to switch gears into the token, okay? Of course, margin lending by definition is not fully collateralized, right? So there has to be some sort of component for ensuring that lenders get the full principal and interest back,
sure.
even when there are unforeseen circumstances. So I believe you tied in the token to help accomplish this. And the token initially was more for paying fees on BZX relays and also served as a governance token, but now it's expanded to a little bit more than that. Can you walk us through the history on the token and where it is now and what you hope to accomplish with that?
Yeah. So originally we had really like we modeled the B0X token after 0x. And 0x, they view their token ultimately as a governance token. And the fee token aspect is really just to drive a distribution of the token into
in a lot of people's hands.
Yeah, into representative stakeholders. And we envision the same thing. Over time, we looked at, you know, what are you governing exactly? And one of the things that we felt was important to govern with our protocol was the insurance fund. So we had always been proposing that there's a form of mandatory self-insurance that if you want to lend out, we take 10% of the interest, we put that in a smart contract, it pays out in the event of a black swan. And that makes lenders more comfortable lending because they know that there's some form of insurance backing up their loan. So we always had this insurance fund. And we saw the idea that our governance token could help manage that fund in a better way, crowdsource wisdom for it. You know, what percentage of interest should go into the fund? What sort of margin maintenance requirements are safe so that it's less likely to experience a black swan event? So we proposed that the token holders can vote on making the token asset backed by the insurance fund and vote on these parameters. And what that does is it gives them skin in the game and gives them an incentive to get these parameters right. They want to set the parameters so that the greatest amount of lending volume can go through. So it's not too high that they dissuade lenders. It's not too low that lenders feel that their funds could be in jeopardy. and that the margin maintenance requirement is set at the level where there's the most amount of activity going through, but without jeopardizing their own funds. So we felt this proposal allowed the token holders to align incentives and protect the insurance fund. And this is like the big first governance initiative proposal that we're putting forward for token holders to consider. And it's really great because it allows value capture without extracting any rent, without taking anything out. The tokens, if it becomes asset-backed, will be valued by the redemption value plus the discounted cash flow into the future. So you wouldn't want to redeem the token because you're going to put more money into the fund and get less out. So you're going to want to keep the token out. And this means that the fund never gets like money taken out of it.
Just to add a little point there, he said redeem. You can actually, as a token holder with BZRX, you can actually redeem it for a proportional amount of the fund. But like you said, there's not really a financial incentive to do that because the fund is going to grow over time. But you could take your BZRX and send it in and get back some of the non-BZRX assets that are in there.
So I'm trying to follow all this. It seems like it's a very delicate balance of how you set the portion of the interest that is collected from interest, the interest that I suppose the lenders are collecting. And it's delicate because you don't want to collect too much and, you know, then the lenders might get upset that their earnings are really being siphoned away. Mm-hmm. And you want to collect enough so that there's enough in the insurance fund for a rainy day, mm-hmm, right?
Right?
So that you have to maintain that delicate balance. The BZRX token holders, which I believe one of the main ways you've received the BZRX is through relayers, right? So relayer fees that are collected. So this incentivizes more relays to happen because now relayers are shareholders of this asset-backed fund.
Exactly.
And yeah, actually have claims to assets that have value, right? Mm-hmm. Am I following all that correctly so far?
Yeah, exactly.
Right. And you know, the BZRX token itself will have value. So it's not like, say they do redeem, it's not like the fund is reducing because they're swapping it for BZRX that also has value and that can be swapped for something else later in the event of a payout. So
when you swap in BZRX into the fund, there's more BZRX now in,
sure,
in the fund, right?
Yeah, right.
What happens in a scenario when BZRX is almost like the majority of the fund or just the allocation of that is too high, right? And you get to this situation where perhaps someone that wants to redeem just like doesn't want to do a partial redemption,
right?
They might just resort to moving this onto the open market, depressing prices, and which also affects, let's say, you know, BZRX was 30% of the fund. Now 30% of the fund is under financial attack outside of the system, really.
Yeah. So there's definitely a possible scenario where the fund becomes collateralized in large part with a BZRX token, but it's contrary to any sort of economic incentives, right? The economic incentives are if you want to capitalize on the value of your BZRX token, you're going to sell it on a secondary market because the value, it's almost like you're when you put the token in the fund, it's almost like you're donating the discounted cash flow to it. You could even imagine a scenario where we had Kyber set up on the front end and it sold the token for you, you know, gave you back what you would have redeemed and then gives the balance to the fund. Like we could, in theory, set up the fund that way, but we're not going to, in large part because it's just creates more surface area and it's just, there's no real economic reason that you would want to just give away money like that. But I think essentially that's a bridge, like it's a very unlikely bridge that we would come to, but that's a bridge that we can definitely handle. Because if the DCF is positive for BZRX, you could go ahead and rebalance it and make the fund even more robust.
Right.
And that's fine. But otherwise, it'll serve as a velocity sink for the supply of BZRX. And a lot of token holders might be pretty happy about that too.
Mm-hmm. And these discounted cash flows that you're anticipating, you're talking about the portion of the interest that is being siphoned into the fund, or are you talking about
right,
the...
Right, exactly.
Okay,
yeah.
Okay.
If 10% is going in, that you know, over time that'll continually grow,
And, you know, there's, you know, incentive just to not redeem, because that's just going to grow.
And you have a BZRX token holder has a proportionate access to the assets of that fund. So if right. I owned, if I'm big relayer on BZX and I own 10% of the tokens, mm-hmm. Then I am entitled to 10% of the asset, the insurance assets, which are growing over time.
Exactly. Right? And okay. like if you're a relayer in that position, essentially means that you're benefiting from like you might as well be receiving 1% of all interest collected on the protocol, mm-hmm. essentially, in terms of how you're capturing value.
Yeah, I think the velocity sinks are also a great consideration here, which wasn't really tackled in the first iteration of the token model. That's all great. Do you think simply it's a little too early for governance in a system like yours, or even in a slightly more mature system like ZeroX, it seems like governance is not something you should be focusing on quite yet. Maybe if you have an ecosystem of several different relayers and lenders and borrowers and you know several components, and they all have some sort of stake in this ecosystem, then it's the time to think about governance. But at this stage, is a focus on governance dilutive to the conversation?
I think that people building projects on BZRX who would potentially be stakeholders in the protocol are very interested in what their ability to capture value is and what's in it for them. So a relay is going to, like, somebody would be much more likely to want to become a BZRX relay if they understand the value proposition of it. So in terms of actually implementing governance, it is too soon to actually do that. And there needs to be a lot more infrastructure in place. Right now, you know, there's a big conversation happening, like Kyber is experimenting with their DAO. And we're going to be watching these experiments that take place and kind of leveraging the insights that they gain. But in terms of clarifying what the value proposition of governance would be in the context of our protocol, it's definitely something that's critical to establishing and growing and nurturing the ecosystem that's growing under BZRX.
Cool. Let's pivot the discussion to your go-to-market strategy. I've seen protocols kind of pick one of three things when they try to monetize on the protocol. Either they have some sort of token that's accruing value to the investors, and you know they're also token holders themselves, so some of that value is accruing to them. Sometimes, and we see this more often than not, especially just with the regulatory environment, yep. and just you know tokens are a tad out of style compared to 2017.
Right.
You see more and more teams productizing, right? So this is kind of like what DYDX and Dharma did. They built Expo and Lever, and these are these products that people will use, and these products will of course collect fees, and so there's some sort of business model for these protocols. The third sort of way I've seen a business model be conducted on protocols is really what Compound is doing. So just capturing some sort of inherent spread in between the market that they're making.
Right.
You guys have done two things now. You now have this token that's accruing value to investors and yourselves and ecosystem players, and you now have the product as well.
Right.
What are your thoughts on all this? What's really your business model? And I have a follow-on question really as well.
Yeah, so we intend to stick with the token model as a way of monetizing. So we're, you know, sharing an ownership of the protocol. We are sort of against the idea of extracting rent from the protocol or adding fees to the protocol. A lot of people are less optimistic about tokens now and are very bullish on these VC-backed companies that are going to just extract rent and take fees. And we think that without a token, it's impossible for you to capture value without extracting rent. And we've demonstrated that it's actually possible to get the best of both worlds, where you capture value and you don't extract rent. And so we have this productized offering, but we never intend to add fees onto it or take people's money. We want this protocol to be free and open and rent-free completely.
Yeah, we are working on some ways for people that want to integrate to kind of monetize. It wouldn't go to us. It'd go like a forwarding contract and stuff like that for people that want to.
Yeah, like just like how 0x Instant allows people who kind of like host the interface to collect an affiliate fee. We want to enable people who host an interface or a relay to be able to collect some kind of fee, like if they want to implement margin tokens or position tokens or something like that. But us personally, we don't intend on having our business model take out fees.
This is actually a really good segue into my next question, which is I saw in the white paper, which actually might be a little bit outdated at this point, is that you have a plan to develop a BZX SDK. So this could be a great distribution strategy to do exactly what you just mentioned. If some relayer, some centralized exchange, decentralized exchange, whatever, it could be a wallet.
Yep.
They want to have these capabilities natively, then you can distribute BZX via this SDK. And of course, you know, this is sort of the flavor of the year, I suppose, especially for my seed, because, you know, Wire does a lot of, we integrate with a lot of great dApps out there. B2B has been really, really picking up in the industry, right?
Right.
And then a lot of the lines are blurring between wallet and dApp, and it's seeming like these wallets that already have users, there's part of their strategy is to bring protocols like yourself to their interface, right? And then in these deals, you can strike up any sort of like referral fees for yourself, licensing agreements, things like that. Is that, how do you think about partnership strategies? How do you think about distribution? How do you think about creating a business around that?
So in terms of like monetizing the business to business aspect?
Right.
I think for us, it all comes down to the value capture of the token. Whatever increases volume on our protocol increases the amount of value that ends up being captured. So we want to provide, you know, these tools for developers completely free of charge, because we're just interested in fostering that kind of adoption and getting and onboarding more people onto the protocol, whatever we can do.
Mm-hmm. And is this value capture that's conducted by the token, is that to sustain developer engagement, you know, throughout the life of the protocol? Let's say, you know, we want these things to live hundreds and hundreds of years, presumably, right? I'm being a little facetious here, but so there will be a day when Tom and Kyle aren't working on BZX, and this is a community-driven effort. Are part of the funds that are collected meant for incentivizing the open source community to pick up where you left off?
That's a tough question, because I think like one thing it's assuming is like funds collected, right? Because there's no actual funds leaving the system at any point. So, you know, there perhaps are ways to sort of like loan the tokens to yourself, maybe with a multi-collateral CDP, and benefit from the value that kind of like flows through without selling the token. And so that could be a way that the community looks to monetize the value flowing through and actually like getting some funds out without, you know, selling the token or reducing your share in the ownership of the protocol. But, you know, how development is funded in the future is not something we've, in terms of like in a community driven way, that's not something we've solved. And it's a very tricky problem because it's very susceptible to attack. And I think this is probably the principal issue that every other project in the space is kind of that wants to do this is kind of wrestling with. Like Kyber's trying to set up a DAO, and 0x would like to have the community direct the funds within the company, but actually doing so is extraordinarily difficult. And we're, I think, in a lot of ways just waiting to see the solutions, or we're
going to watch what others are doing and draw inspiration from that.
Yeah. And I think this, you know, it needs to some extent be driven by the community at large. Like these are big problems that we can't solve ourselves.
Is part of the token float set aside to encourage developers to built on top of the protocol to incentivize, you know, new products to be built? How do you think about that?
Yeah, we have part of the tokens allocated towards a development fund. Our token allocation is like very similar, almost identical to that of 0x. So just like they, you know, give grants out in order to foster community development, we're going to have many of the similar programs that we're going to be fostering. So we're going to try to encourage the 0x ecosystem because we, you know, in a lot of ways, we see the 0x ecosystem as like the B0x ecosystem as well.
Awesome. Last couple questions for me. Regulatory strategy. So insurance funds are highly regulated. Actually, they're not regulated at the federal level of last time I checked here in the US, but they are regulated state by state. Mm-hmm. And they are regulated at the you know, nation state level in Europe and Asia and so on and so forth. How do you think about your insurance fund navigating these waters?
Well, it's not, you know, obviously it's not a traditional insurance fund that, you know, someone's paying premiums into. I mean, we could probably call it something else, not call it insurance fund. I mean, it's not real insurance. It's just kind of a pool that is there for, I don't know, how do you want to answer that?
Here's the thing. Our lawyers have never brought up that this might be an issue for us. Like we've had CFT, we've had lawyers like deep dive on the protocol, go through, you know, set us up for CFTC compliance,
yep,
set us up for compliance with security laws. We've talked to our lawyers about the insurance fund. At no point have the lawyers ever said like, oh, and by the way, you have to comply with XYZ regulations around it. And why that is, I couldn't say for sure because I'm not a lawyer, but I imagine it might have something to do with the fact that it's completely non-custodial. It's just a contract that
holds funds and, you know, pays you some if when there's a black swan event. And it's not like, yeah, and you're not paying premiums to it.
Yeah, I imagine the fact that we're not administering it in any way sort of frees us from duties and responsibilities related to it. Like whoever is administering an insurance fund, I'm sure will have to comply with laws related to that. But I think the fact that we can't access any of the funds in there, so we couldn't pull it out if we wanted to, that sort of makes us like an irrelevant party in the scheme of like, you know, who's responsible for it? Not us. So I think that's
part of it. You know, to Tom's point, calling it not an insurance fund is probably a really good start, right?
it's tricky.
It's just something else.
It's tricky, yeah, too, because like, you know, you want to use terms that like people can easily kind of grapple with and conceptualize, but at the same time, you do want to be accurate. So, you know, we call it an insurance fund just because like, you know, it's like, hey, this helps you if something bad happens, and people have a schema for that already.
Yep. One other thing I saw on your roadmap online, and this takes me to the next section, which is really about the vision of the company or the protocol. What are your thoughts on cross-chain asset lending? How do you hope to accomplish this in the BZX protocol? Are you going to do this natively or work with other partners?
So when we originally wrote that part of the roadmap out, this was something that we were really interested in doing, and you know, we started researching it. And upon researching it, we realized that this is not really our problem to solve. In a way, like
there's a lot of good projects focused solely on that. You know,
yeah, and it's actually quite trivial for us to leverage the work that other projects are doing. So, for example, like Kybert partnered with Wanchain, and at some point, I assume is going to support like reserves that go across chains. And when Kyber supports a token, our protocol automatically supports that token too. So the moment that Kyber has reserves that can work with you know, other assets that are on other chains, our protocol immediately, automatically now is cross chain. So it's upon a really diving down into the problem and trying to understand it, we realize that it's like going to solve itself.
Awesome. Last question is an easy one. Actually, I guess I have two questions left that are very easy. First of those is, Are there any positions you want to advertise to our audience of developers and crypto heads?
Yeah. User experience researchers, user experience designers, product managers, and Solidity developers. All of these positions we are hiring for. Please send us your resumes to team@bzx.network.
Yeah, we don't have any posted, but we do, we're always willing to look at quality resumes and consider quality people. So, yep, send us your resumes.
Awesome. And where is the best place for people to get in touch with you or read about the work that BZX is doing?
So we have, we post a lot on Medium. So we go to, Medium and our BZX network on Medium, medium.com/BZX network, or you can go to our website, BZX.network. And, obviously check out Fulcrum is going to be fulcrum.trade once that launches.
Awesome. Well, thanks for joining us today, Tom and Kyle.
Thank you. Yeah, it's been fun.
Thanks.
Yeah.
Yeah. Likewise. Thanks for joining us today. To learn more about BZX, check out the show notes included in your podcast and remember to subscribe to get the latest episodes. If you have any questions or comments, reach out to us on Twitter, Facebook, LinkedIn, or the Wire blog, whatever works for you. If you like this episode, share it with your friends and colleagues. Thanks again for listening.